all of the usual forms of political protest with which we're familiar in the West were banned. So what could people do? What people could do was to withhold their energy, their strength, their creativity. Now, in a Stalinist world, where the only meaning to life, right, is work, the most fundamental form of resistance is withholding of one's creativity and enthusiasm and inventiveness from the, what we call the economic system. And that's exactly what the Russians have done. But the people from the top down are trying to introduce markets. The people from the bottom up, they want space to live. They want more choice.
The workers.
The workers, yeah, the people in the country. They want freedom to live, to craft their lives in whichever direction that they want. They don't want to be told what to do by the state. They don't want to be told what to do by a General Motors either, as those who would introduce capitalism into Eastern Europe and in Soviet Union may discover.
From his earliest writings, Marx was a critic of bureaucracy and was for radical democracy. This is almost never cited in all the discussions of this. It's usually blamed. Karl Marx is usually blamed for being the father of the totalitarian state, and these events in Eastern Europe are, in a sense, being usually interpreted as the failures of Marxism.
That's right. That's exactly right. And it's a false reasoning, as false as it is to blame Jesus Christ for the Inquisition in the Middle Ages.
Momentous events are occurring in the communist countries all over the world. We have two professors of Marxism to help explain things to us right now on Alternative Views.
Hello, welcome to Alternative Views. Today we're going to do a program on the turmoil in the communist world. Our guest is University of Texas economics professor Harry Cleaver. Harry is author of Reading Capital Politically and a forthcoming study of left independent opposition to Marxist-Leninist orthodoxy.
But before we have our interview, here are some news stories from the Alternative Press.
In one of the most significant events of the civil war in El Salvador, six priests were killed in a campus raid in San Salvador on November the 17th, 1989. The media coverage of these events is very interesting because the New York Times and the mainstream media first attempted to blame the killing on nobody. They weren't sure whether it was the right wing, the left wing, the government, or whatever, but the way that they framed the news story the first day, it made it appear that probably the rebels in El Salvador killed these left-wing priests. The headline of the New York Times read, "Government denies a role in hints at rebel plot. Inquiry is promised," as if the government of El Salvador was somehow innocent of this, as if they were not implicated in the death squads that have been rampant in El Salvador for decades. The next day, after all of the news reports had indicated that it was probably the army and death squads that killed the priests in El Salvador because the rifles used to kill them were those used by the army, because the people that were seen going into the Salvador University were dressed in army uniforms, and because the army had surrounded the campus for days, had even entered the priest's compound a couple times to search for rebels in there. The army had been part of that environment for the last few days. Everyone, all the observers, said that the rebels couldn't have done it. It must be the death squads or the army, which are actually the same thing. On Saturday, November the 18th, the headline of the Times was, U.S. official links Salvadorian right to priest deaths. The Senate had a panel on an inquiry into who murdered the six priests, and a fellow from the State Department, Bernard Aronson, who has replaced Elliot Abrams as the top State Department official on Central America, came in and said it was the right wing, it was the death squads, which are out of control, that are no longer under control by the Salvadorian government. Well, this is interesting because it again exonerates the government for responsibility as if it was death squads that somehow are outside of or beyond or different than the Salvadorian government, which is currently being controlled by the Arena Party, one of whom's founders, Roberto Dabasson, was one of the individuals in El Salvador most involved in forming, training, and actually involvement in the death squads.
What kind of people are the people who run the Salvadoran government? Well, here's a quote from Roberto Dabasson, who is the head man in the Arena Party, which now controls the government. He said, "You Germans are very intelligent. You realize that Jews were responsible for communism and you began to kill them." How about that? And the General Sigifredo Ochoa, vice president of the Legislative Assembly, recently declared, according to The Nation, "The methods of political solution are exhausted in El Salvador. That's what the armed forces are for." In 1945, the decision was taken to end the war by dropping atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Nice guys. That's why they could be another one of the reasons they had the big helicopter gunships and the C-47s and all, and their artillery just firing indiscriminately into these areas of rebel control in El Salvador. Well, what about the new president of Arena, Armando Calderon Sol, the mayor of San Salvador? Well, he said he was going to organize community watch squads in 150 of the city's shanty towns, and this is the start before their total war. This is a term they use down there, before their total war takes place. It's a strategy that the military particularly talk about, and most recently in their call for a state of siege. Now, what does total war mean to them? Well, it'll be dismantling peasant cooperatives, cutting off credits and supplies in hopes of forcing desperate peasants to sell their land back to the oligarchs, and the elimination of taxes on sugar and coffee exports. And naturally, the destruction of the unions. They've been attacking all of these people for such a long time, and it was talked about in an interview we had with some people representing the rebels, FMLN. They were saying, "We can't stand by and let our people in the cities just be destroyed by these death squads and by this new total war that's going on. We have to take action in order to try to help them, or at least deflect the terror which the government is foisting on the people, at least to the fighting the rebels." So that may be one of the reasons they stepped up their war. Plus, I think they've said that they wanted to bring El Salvador back to the center focus of the media in the Western world, particularly the United States, because the United States and the government have been shoveling it under the rug, hoping El Salvador will go away, or the government will be able to do their dirty work without the microscope of the national and international media on it.
There's a book by Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky called Manufacturing Consent that does an analysis of the mass media and the way they serve the propaganda functions of the U.S. government. Chomsky and Herman did a study over 15 years of the way that the media covered worthy victims of government genocide and unworthy victims. For instance, if a communist country killed someone in that country, there was tremendous amounts of media coverage, the most spectacular of which was a solidarity priest, Jerzy Popielucko, who in 1984 was arrested by the Polish government for his political activities, was beaten, and some government thugs got out of control and beat the priest to death. And there were something like 78 articles in the New York Times and something like 10 front page stories, many editorials, and saturation media coverage about the death of this Polish priest, who was a worthy victim because he was a victim of a communist government. Whereas there were 72 religious victims in Latin America from 1964 to 1978, there were only 8 articles in the New York Times in that whole cumulative period about all of these victims. Similarly, there were 23 religious murders, that is, of religious figures in Guatemala from January of 1980 through 1985, and there are only a handful of stories about these victims. When the Bishop of El Salvador, Oscar Romero, was murdered in his cathedral on a Sunday in San Salvador, there were again only a tenth of the number of stories that were dedicated to this Polish priest, and so on. So that these religious, these murders of religious victims usually get the amount of coverage they do as to whether the country that they're murdered in is an ally or an enemy of the United States. So it'll be interesting to see if the media continue their focus on these six religious figures, these six priests who were also professors at the university, or whether they simply dropped the story. Everyone's agreed that this is one of the most barbaric murders in recent history, where the six priests, as well as the woman who cooks for them and their 15-year-old daughter, were torn out of their sleeping quarters in the university, were shot and tortured and murdered. And again, there hasn't been all that much focus on this event, despite the enormity of the crime. The first night that it happened, there were tornadoes and floods in the United States, and those stories, again, dominated the news with only very small coverage of this death that could be a turning point in the El Salvador war.
We'll have more news later. Now let's turn our attention to Eastern Europe and the amazing events there. Our special guest is Dr. Harry Cleaver, professor of economics at the University of Texas, who teaches Marxist economics. And, of course, Doug Kellner teaches courses in Marxist philosophy at the university.
Harry, tonight we want to discuss the communist world, and we see nightly images of demonstrations of dramatic changes in government policies and even governments, surprising events like the coming down of the Berlin Wall. What's really going on behind these events?
I think what we're seeing is an incredibly exciting international cycle of struggles that is sweeping the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, of the sort that we haven't seen since Prague in 68, since Hungary in 56, East Germany in 53. Those were constituted cycles of struggles which were crushed. These seem to be being successful, and what they're doing is bringing about the defeat of a whole historical period, the period of Stalinism in Eastern Europe.
And what do you think the people are struggling for and against, specifically in these countries?
I think they're struggling for better lives. They're struggling for better lives in a lot of different ways. Material, certainly a material standard of living, which is better, but also for political freedom, for a different kind of lifestyle in which you can determine what you want to do and where you're going to do it and with whom you're going to do it. It's the great rigidity of socialism as we have known it in the last 50 years, against which they're rebelling, of which the police state, of course, is just the worst part.
Was this triggered, you think, by Gorbachev and Perestroika and all the changes that are coming
Absolutely.
Across there?
The Soviet Union, of course, was the fountainhead of Stalinism itself. Right? It was Stalin that imposed Soviet-style communism on Eastern Europe. It was the struggle against Stalinism, the persistent, long-term resistance of the Soviet people, which brought about the failure of Stalinism. It's what forced Perestroika It's what forced glasnost. I think it's sad that American commentators have picked up on Gorbachev's own projected self-image to say this is a revolution from the top down. It's not a revolution from the top down. What it is a managerial attempt to reorganize itself in order to cope with its inability to manage a people who for 50 years, faced with a police state, have been pursuing a policy of subterranean resistance against that police state.
Isn't there another current in this also, the fact that the Soviet economic system has, being so bureaucratic and elephantine, has just not been able to keep up with the modern technological advances in the world, and so they're not able to compete?
I wouldn't separate the resistance, the political resistance, from economic resistance, because the fundamental form of the resistance that people have been using is economic. It's a resistance to work. It's a resistance to doing what the state wants you to do. Right? I mean, they have, under Stalinism, you didn't have the opportunity to speak up. Right? There's no freedom of speech. You didn't have the opportunity to gather together. There's no freedom of assembly. Never was. You can't go on strike. That was outlawed. All of the usual forms of political protest with which we're familiar in the West were banned. So what could people do? What people could do was to withhold their energy, their strength, their creativity. Now, in the Stalinist world, where the only meaning to life, right, is work, the most fundamental form of resistance is withholding of one's creativity and enthusiasm and inventiveness from the, what we call the economic system. And that's exactly what the Russians have done. They've done it in the countryside.
The Russian people.
The Russian people, right. From the peasant resistance to collectivization back in the 30s when they slaughtered their cattle, they slaughtered their horses and their pigs to prevent the state from taking them over, to the persistent post-war resistance, which has involved flight from the countryside, stealing of grain and the food from the state, to the resistance in the factories. It's well known among economists that almost every job position in the Soviet Union for the last 50 years has been overmanned because the people aren't doing the work. There's an enormous amount of unemployment in the Soviet Union, but it's not reported. It doesn't appear, right? Because everybody has a guaranteed job. What they really means is they have a guaranteed place to go and they have a guaranteed wage, but they're not necessarily working. Even in some of the most modern Soviet industries, you find two, three people doing the work of one person, and all of them together doing less than half of the work of one person. So the political resistance has predominantly taken the form of an economic resistance, an unwillingness to cooperate. And this has run from the plant floor and from the fields around the collective farms right up through the bureaucracy. One of the fundamental characteristics of Soviet bureaucracy, like bureaucracies everywhere, is its rigidity. Right? It doesn't flex, it doesn't move, it can't cope. It takes the rules which have been handed down and it turns them into excuses for not doing what needs to be done. I mean, this is classic characteristic of bureaucracy, I think, everywhere. But in the Soviet Union, this has developed to a high art. So what is called the inefficiencies of centralized bureaucratic planning has to be understood, it seems to me, in terms of the way that people throughout the economic system, not just at the bottom, but even up through the bureaucracy, have used the structure for their own purposes of resisting the state in its attempt to use them for its purpose. But it also leads to rigidity, to a lack of flexibility. And it's that, I think, that people have in mind more than anything else when they talk about the failure of the Soviet economy to keep up with the rest of the world. That the Western way of organizing the accumulation of capital is much more flexible. You have room, people have room for maneuver. They can protest. If they don't like a job here, they can go get a job over there. I mean, they have to get a job, but at any rate, they can move. And because of that, because they have a certain amount of power to move, business has to be more responsive to them. Right? So the system has greater flexibility. The Soviets haven't had that. A good example of that is in computers. Everybody knows, or at least many people know, that Soviets are decades behind the West in terms of computer development. Why? Well, the most obvious reason is that in the West, everybody has computers and they play with them. There's enormous flexibility in the development of computer hardware and the development of computer software. In the Soviet Union, which has been a police state up until now, They've been afraid to let people have computers because they're afraid that they'll be used, right, to produce underground newspapers, poetry, samizdat, right, against the state. So they've been kept tightly controlled. The people who have access to them have been highly numbered. And that's an extremely rigid situation. And they can't develop the computer industry under those circumstances.
But Harry, don't you think that the current range of struggle, the cycle of struggles, also has a more marked political dimension than we've ever seen in communist countries before? That is, they're fighting for political freedoms, for democracy.
Absolutely.
For participation in the government, for freedom to travel, freedom of speech,
personal
assembly.
Freedom.
But let's not forget that those same things were being. That's not true, Doug. If you think back and look at what happened, not on such a scale, of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole thing's blowing wide open.
Right.
But if you look back in 1956 in the Hungarian Revolution, what happened? I mean, they didn't just try to throw off the oppressor, right? They overthrew the Hungarian puppet government, and then the workers moved to form workers' councils, right, in each place of production, and in the city in Budapest,
right,
and they were forming them in the countryside. They were, in fact, taking over and transforming the whole society in an extremely democratic way, so that even the resistance back in the 50s had these same qualities. It's just that they were crushed.
And why did they fail at that point in history, and why are they succeeding, or at least seeming to succeed now?
The post-war period has seen a whole series of concessions, bit by bit. I mean, de-Stalinization really began in 1953 with the death of Stalin and with Khrushchev's famous speech,
right,
pointing out the horrors of Stalinism. Khrushchev himself moved, right, to begin economic reforms in the Soviet Union, to loosen things up. Brezhnev and Kosygin in the 60s, much maligned from the point of view of political freedoms, were in fact involved in an almost Keynesian-like reform of the Soviet economy, trying to make it more responsive to people's demands. They're the ones who are responsible for giving a wage to everybody on the collective farms, to creating pensions for peasants and so on. Those were attempts to make marginal changes within the general framework of a Stalinist economy.
Right.
And I think what happened was that they tried and they tried and they discovered that they just wouldn't work. And in the end, they concluded, and I think that this really begins, we say that the perestroika begins in the Soviet Union, but in a real sense, perestroika began in 1970 when Poland blew sky high. You remember, in December, Christmas 1970, when the Polish communist government announced the doubling of food prices the night before Christmas with a typical subtlety of Eastern Bloc governments. Overnight, Poland blew sky high. They rescinded the price increases. It happened again in 76. The Russians were so shaken by what happened that they revised the five-year plan in the Soviet Union in response to these events to increase the production of consumer goods. In 1972, they turned to the United States and imported a fantastic amount of grain. For what? So they could produce more meat to meet the demands of their people. So they've been making concessions, but they just hadn't gotten to the point where they felt that fundamental reforms, truly fundamental reforms, had to be undertaken. I think that they came to that. That's what Gorbachev represents. He is the individual who embodies that conclusion, which has been accumulating over this long period of time.
Harry, we see on television all the time and on the radio the fact that they're wanting democracy and capitalism in Eastern Europe, and it shows that Marxism is dead, and that everybody wants to import John Maynard Keynes and Adam Smith. And yet, at the same time, as in China and some interviews I've heard with people in East Germany, many of them want to continue the so-called Marxist path. They don't want capitalism. How do you read what people are wanting? Yet, on the other hand, different of what used to be the satellite countries, seem to be Hungary, for instance, seems to be wanting more capitalism and more Western type of democracy than other countries. How do you read what's going on in this respect?
I think that you have to read it from the top down and from the bottom up. The people at the top down want flexibility because the rigid systems of managerial control that they've been using haven't been working. They want the major thrust has been towards the decentralization of planning and the substitution of market mechanisms for planning. That's what people are talk about when they say introduction of capitalism. It's not exactly the introduction of capitalism. I mean, there are those who have argued cogently that we've had capitalism in the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe. It's just a state capitalism, in which the state owns all the capitalism, but that the basic object of the economy is the same, which is to say, put everybody to work in the endless accumulation of wealth. But the people from the top down are trying to introduce markets. The people from the bottom up, they want space to live. They want more choice.
The workers.
The workers, yeah, the people in the country. They want freedom to live, to craft their lives in whichever direction that they want. They don't want to be told what to do by the state. They don't want to be told what to do by a General Motors either, as those who would introduce capitalism into Eastern Europe and in Soviet Union may discover. They're like us. They want to be able free to craft their own lives. So those are two very different things. Now, what may be shaping up, for there's the tragedy of this period of change, is that from the point of view of the people on the top, there are only two choices, centralized planning versus decentralized markets. That's a direct reflection of the entire history of the bipolar world. The Soviet Union has always represented centralized top-down planning, rigid, all top-down, no bottom-up at all. On the other hand, the so-called free markets of the West, which of course we know are not really free, they're highly managed, frequently from the top down, but nevertheless, those were the two models. There's no third way being envisaged by the people at the top. It's a substitution of the one for the other. And it's sad and it's tragic, because the fact is not that we're substituting a capitalist control for a people's control. There has never been popular planning in Eastern Europe or the Soviet Union. We don't know what that might be like. We don't know what it would be like if people control the means of production, if people control the cities, if the peasants control the countryside and decided to allocate resources according to their own needs. I mean, that's the kind of thing that 100 years ago people meant by socialism.
Well, what is
but we haven't had that.
Harry, what is the alternative to either a state-controlled economy or a market-controlled capitalist economy?
Well, I would say that it is just exactly the kind of thing I was just talking about.
A people's controlled
which
economy.
Is to say, the experiment which has yet to happen in the world, which is to let people decide what they want to do with their lives and with their productive activities and with the distribution of resources. I mean, these are not subjects which are open for discussion in the East.
Right.
These were questions that were being decided by a small group of Politburo members, a group of Communist Party members, the same way a great deal of this is decided in the West by the corporate boards of directors. General Motors is a bigger corporation than most countries in the world. They decide internally the allocation of resources and overproduction, the same way the Planning Bureau in the Soviet Union decides, from the top down.
Harry, how does this relate, the ideal that you're indicating of autonomous people's control of the economy, with the views of Karl Marx? It seems that there's some tension within classical Marxism. On one hand, Marx wants to nationalize the means of production. He wants
to socialize the means
of production, the people to own the industry, transportation, communication. On the other hand, he wants the people to control their lives through popular democracy, through controlling the economy, their community, etc. Isn't there a tension between having the state or even the people as a sort of totality owning all the means of production and then democratic control at the workplace, in the community, at the base?
I think Marxism stopped being Marxism historically in the transition from Karl Marx's call for the socialization of the means of production, right, for workers' control of production and distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And the transition from that, or the conversion of that vision into the vision of nationalization. This is what happened with Lenin and with Stalin. What does it mean for people to socialize the means of production? It means that the people who are doing the production control production,
mm-hmm.
but in a large sense. I mean, we shouldn't forget that Marx said that the capitalist system of production includes both production and distribution, mm-hmm. right? And so certainly a post-capitalist order could be no less. It means that people in a collectivity control both their production and the distribution. I mean, this concept was directly related to the old communist slogan, from each according to their ability, to each according to their needs. These two things were tied. But what happened after when the Bolsheviks consolidated power in the Soviet Union, and Leninism took power, and Leninism gradually turned into Stalinism, is that that concept was converted into one of nationalization. People controlling their means of production and distribution became the state controlling the means of production.
And indeed, the party...
The state as the representative of the people.
Right, and then the party being the control mechanism of the state, and the central committee being the control mechanism of the party, and then the dictator, in the case of
Stalin,
the representative of the party.
That's right.
And it's interesting to say that Marx never had a notion of a communist state as such. He talked about the withering away of the state under communism. Plus, Marx never had any notion of a party bureaucracy.
That's right.
From his earliest writings, Marx was a critic of bureaucracy and was for radical democracy. This is almost never cited in all the discussions of this. It's usually blamed. Karl Marx is usually blamed for being the father of the totalitarian state, and these events in Eastern Europe are, in a sense, being usually interpreted as the failures of Marxism.
That's right. That's exactly right. And it's a false reasoning, as false as it is to blame Jesus Christ for the Inquisition in the Middle Ages.
Well, Marx himself at one time said, I'm not a Marxist, after seeing what was done in his name, right?
That's right. I mean, that's the fact of the matter is that the Eastern Bloc governments, countries, ideologues, have used Marxism as an ideology to justify top-down, centralized control, police state coercion of people's lives. Now, for what? 80 years? 70 years?
Harry, I was wanting to ask you this. It seems like things are happening so fast in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. There was so much ferment from the bottom. It looks like things could come unraveled very easily, and no telling what's liable to happen.
That's right. That's precisely why the situation is so exciting. Things are coming unraveled. They're already unraveled in terms of both economics and politics. The situation is in extreme state of flux. The reaction of the Bush administration to this is symptomatic of that, right?
Yes.
They're worried.
They just, wow, what's happening?
For 40 years, the American government and other capitalist governments in the West have called on Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union to change, have called on people to rise up and to change the situation, right? They like to use these kind of populist appeals overseas.
To democratize being the main demand of the U.S. government.
That's right.
Fighting for human rights and democracy.
That's right. But now that it's happening, they're scared to death.
Right.
They're scared to death of the situation, and they're trying to figure out how to help stabilize it.
Well,
I think we should see that in the aid, in the tiny packages of aid that they're talking about giving to Poland or to East Germany, or let's say that the West Germans, the coal is now talking about giving to East Germany. They're doing it to stabilize the situation. I mean, coal in West Germany is even telling East Germans now to stay home.
Well, also, this will mean the loss of very important ways of social control of you and I. The U.S. government for decades has been waving the red banner of communism as a way to keep out political and economic discussion or change, try to keep all of us in line, use that as an excuse to have this bloated Pentagon budget. And now, without this, what are they going to do? I saw in Dallas on a TV program, they were saying, oh my gosh, with all these changes in Western Europe, we may have unemployment here in Dallas. I mean, in Eastern Europe, we're going to have unemployment in Dallas because
cut back on defense?
Yeah, cut back on defense.
Yes, I think it was 60 Minutes a couple of weeks ago that had a very nice interview with two generals, one American and one Russian. The American was in the Soviet Union. And the interviewer put to these two generals, said, well, guys, if you are not each other's enemies anymore, then what are all these weapons for?
Also, all of the...
To which they had no answer.
There's also hundreds of thousands of American troops that are stationed in Europe that cost billions of dollars a year, multi-billion dollars, to protect Europe from the communist masses or the communist army, military machine that was supposed to overrun Western Europe. And now it's just tourists or refugees or exiles from East Germany that are, or the Eastern Bloc that are pouring into Western Europe. So that raises the question, what is the American military doing there? So this whole commitment of the U.S. to military forces in Europe, NATO, all of these things are being put into a dramatic question, and the Bush administration, and indeed the entire American government, hasn't begun to react to these, to think through what the implications are.
I think that probably they need to be thinking through what the implications are. I don't expect them to react just yet, because as when you said a few minutes ago, might not the whole situation unravel? I think you meant not only that it is unraveling, but that the social, what's viewed as social chaos, might reach such a point that the Soviets might feel obligated to intervene in some way or another.
Exactly.
And
their nationalities
are not about to disband the Warsaw Pact forces when there's any chance that those forces may be needed for the only purpose that they have ever really served, and that is for the maintenance of social order in Eastern Europe. So they're not about to disband them, and of course the Americans and the West Germans are not about to disband their forces in West Germany unless there's a mutual disbanding of forces in Eastern Europe.
I can see the Western capitalist countries, particularly the Western financial institutions and big corporations, licking their chops, thinking they're going to be able to move into Eastern Europe and take over or control a lot of the industry and finance and make them economic satellites of the United States like they've done so much with the Third World. Do you see this happening at all? I see statements in the United States and West Germany say, okay, we may give you this aid, but you've got to take these steps to have austerity, to promote free enterprise based upon economic penetration of multinational corporations, et cetera. They're treating them just like Third World countries.
Well, in many ways, they are like Third World countries. We should recognize that. I think that what we're beginning to see is exactly the same kind of planning that was being done during World War II. During as early as 1943, economists in the West working for the American and British governments were planning on how to move in, reorganize, and exploit Eastern Europe at the end of the war. They didn't know at the time that the Soviets were going to do just that. They thought that the West was going to be able to do that. One of the seminal articles in the whole literature of economic development was one written by Rosenstein Rodin on this subject. We're seeing the same kind of discussions, of course. Perhaps we could put this simply by saying that Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union are viewed as having a large, cheap labor force. The West has large amounts of capital. The way to develop Eastern Europe, right, and the Soviet Union.
From their point of view, yeah.
To help them develop is to bring those two things together. Now, to some degree, of course, some of that cheap labor will come west, the way they are doing in East Germany right now, to compete against more highly paid workers in the West. In fact, a lot of West German workers are getting very worried about this massive flux through the Berlin Wall and across the border. On the other hand, I think it's clear the multinational corporations in the West are in fact gearing up. In fact, there's a new business magazine which has just come out about doing business in the East. You know the publication Business International? Well, there's an associated publication called Business Eastern Europe, which has been around for a while. I don't think there's any question about what this is, they have this in mind.
Harry, one of the things that interests me about this these events, this turmoil in the communist world, is how it refutes the right-wing vision of this monolithic totalitarian bloc that can never be reformed or changed. Jean Kirkpatrick, for instance, who's gotten all sorts of government jobs because of an early article that she wrote that distinguished between authoritarian governments that were nasty fascist regimes, but ones that could be reformed and overthrown, as opposed to totalitarian communist regimes, which could never be reformed, that could never change, and therefore had to be destroyed. That's been the basis of U.S. foreign policy during the entire Reagan period, that we ally ourselves with states like Chile and El Salvador, South Africa, and other sorts of authoritarian governments, because they're preferable to the communist governments, the totalitarian ones we should fight to reform. Whereas now one sees the most dramatic reform anywhere in the world going on in the communist world. We see communist governments resigning, handing over state power to their opposition, or allowing democratic elections, as in Poland, which again, the right said a communist regime will never allow democratic elections, will never allow itself to be voted out of power. And this is what has precisely happened.
So, well, that was an ideology, yeah. An ideology that was obviously designed to defend American support for police states in Latin America and elsewhere in the world. What's interesting, it seems to me, mm-hmm. about this phenomenon mm-hmm. is that we've now had the experience of both kinds of regimes being changed for the same reasons. Not because they, at the level of the regime, they have any intrinsic flexibility, but in both cases we've seen regimes been made bankrupt by popular movements from below.
Right.
Whether it's the generals in Brazil or in Argentina, which were the kind of regimes that Kirkpatrick would have us support,
right.
or the regimes of Eastern Europe. In both cases, these changes come about not because of the nature of the regime, which is what she was playing on to justify Reagan policy, but through mass movements from the bottom, which made, despite the fact that they controlled the guns, but they controlled the police state apparatus, they could not make the society work. They could not make the economy work. And they're having to step aside, at least to some degree. The generals, of course, have not entirely disappeared in Brazil or Argentina, nor, of course, have the communist parties entirely disappeared in the countries in Eastern Europe, even where they've essentially handed over a lot of power to non-communist forces. They still retain control over the military and the police and so on.
Or China, which is one of the exceptions in this turmoil in the communist world, whereas reform was allowed, sometimes dramatic reform, in all the countries in Eastern Europe and in the Soviet Union itself. In China, of course, we saw the old Stalinist regime refusing to let go and brutally suppressing the demonstrators.
Well, I think that the situation in China brings out the Soviet distinction between perestroika and glasnost. Perestroika refers to the restructuring of the economy, the introduction of market mechanisms, the attempt to introduce flexibility. Glasnost refers to the political opening, right? Freedom
and
of speech, freedom of political debate, ultimately freedom for non-communists to participate in government, in elections, and so on. China, the crackdown that we saw last May against the Chinese student revolt in China, was essentially a crackdown at the level of glasnost. There has been some marginal pulling back from the perestroika style reforms that the Chinese introduced before Gorbachev, but it's only been a marginal pulling back. I mean, that has not basically been undone. I mean, we should remember that the Chinese introduced considerable market flexibility with respect to agriculture and with respect to the cities. Plus, China is a good example of the phenomena that you were talking about a moment ago, about American multinationals coming in, because the Chinese opened their borders several years ago to American multinational corporations who have invested in China, in Shanghai and the other industrial cities along the South Coast, where they are today exploiting Chinese teenagers at incredibly low wages, at incredibly long hours, under conditions which resemble those of 19th century English textile. That has not changed. There's been a slowdown of American investment there because of the perceived instability, political instability in the country. I think the fear in the Soviet Union, the major one, and also in Eastern Europe, we still have to fear, is a crackdown at the level of glasnost. In fact, the Czechs just smashed a demonstration in Prague with brute force. That's still possible, that they may try. They may try, right, if they perceive things getting completely out of hand, to try to smash freedom of speech, freedom of political discussion, that kind of activity. I see no indication that they're going to be able, that they have any idea about how to reverse the processes of perestroika. Now, some of those processes are not very far advanced. Gorbachev has been trying to bring about more changes than he has actually accomplished. And, of course, many of the countries in Eastern Europe are even less along the path. And although the changes have been most dramatic at the level of glasnost, I think that it's the changes at the level of perestroika which will prove to be absolutely the most durable, although both may.
There can also be a lot of opposition by the workers to perestroika because they don't want to give up necessarily that nice, cushy, easy job and the guaranteed wage and all. And
that's right.
With the perestroika coming in and introducing free markets and unemployment, they may sabotage it themselves.
Well, they're already doing that. I think that's clear. We should have no illusion about the nature of perestroika. Perestroika is not designed, you know, to hand freedom over to the Soviet people. Perestroika is the changes in industrial structure that we associate with perestroika are designed to give the government more control over the labor force. You mentioned the introduction of unemployment. This has been verboten in the Soviet Union since the revolution. I mean, a basic tenet of Marxist-Leninist ideology was that the advantage of Soviet-style socialism over Western-style capitalism was the absence of unemployment. Workers have essentially had guaranteed jobs, at least guaranteed wages, whether they work or not. They have guaranteed low-cost housing. They have more or less guaranteed basic, low-cost basic foodstuffs.
Socialism, in other words.
Health. That's been the material reality of socialism.
Right.
Free medical care, free education.
And that's what they don't want to give up.
And there's no way they want to give it up. But what the government is talking about doing is forcing them, taking those things away from them in order to get control over them, to be able to put them to work harder and longer. I mean, the introduction of unemployment, which has been discussed among the Gorbachev reformers, is aimed exactly at that.
It's social control to get them to work harder. If they don't work, then they can lose their jobs.
It's a classic capitalist mechanism from the West.
Right, they're thrown into the labor market.
Fear of losing your job and losing your house and losing your income will lead you to do what the planners or what the local managers want you to do.
But, Harry, isn't democracy also a part of perestroika? In other words, not only is there a changing, a restructuring of the economy that might give government more power to discipline the workers, but at the same time, they're allowing more democracy, being forced to, because there's a demand for more democratic participation.
What you're saying is correct, which is to say that the fabric of Stalinist control has been continuous through politics, culture, and the economy, right, throughout society. And if fundamental change in the economic order can only be achieved, I think this is what Gorbachev understands, through fundamental change throughout the society. In other words, how are you going to get people to be creative and to contribute to production if you're not allowing them to be creative and imaginative at the level of culture and politics?
Right.
And that's why it is understood that glasnost and perestroika should go together.
Right.
All right? And that's going to be... That's what would be problematic about an attempt to crack down on glasnost while attempting to go forward with perestroika. I think it's not clear that it would work.
Well, this is what the Chinese are attempting to do.
That's right. That's precisely right. Mm. But then it's unclear just what's going to be the upshot of what the Chinese have done. I mean, it may well be, we don't know. It may well be that not only is American business slowing down its attempt to go in and exploit Chinese workers, but it may also be that the Chinese workers are reacting to this crackdown in ways which are dramatically undermining the ability of the Chinese government to manage.
Harry, you've been, as a professor of Marxist economics, and it's what your PhD is in, you've studied it for a long, long time. How do you put this into historical perspective and projecting it into the future? Is this something that
you can really see or have anticipated as a long-term process? And if so, is this something which will move to a certain direction toward more capitalism or democracy and openness and then move back again? Or will it create a synthesis where there will be more democratic socialism?
You know, I've always tried to leave prophecy to the Old Testament.
Well, gray your beard up and testify right now.
The situation is extremely open. It's extremely open and it could go in any direction. We're observing a tremendous cycle of struggle, which is transforming, seems to be transforming Eastern Europe and the Soviet bloc. The kind of thing which we saw in the West in the 1960s and 1970s, which precipitated crisis for Western capitalism, which they still haven't really resolved. We're now seeing that kind of thing in the East. Where it's going to wind up, what will be the upshot of it, is really hard to say. If we look to the past to try to inform the present, we know that even though the upheavals in Eastern Germany in 1953, in Hungary in 1956, and to some degree Czechoslovakia in 1968, that those upheavals did bring about substantial change in those economies. Not democracy. The Soviet tanks crushed the workers' councils in Germany. The Soviets and the East German army crushed the upheaval in Eastern Germany. But the upshot were fundamental changes in those countries, which were important. Up until the recent wave of struggles and upheaval in Eastern Europe, where did one want to go? One wanted to go precisely to those countries, if one were to choose where to live, say the way Polish Americans sometimes do when they get ready to retire. They want to go precisely to those countries where those struggles had taken place, which were in fact transformed by those struggles. I don't think there's any going back. We don't know exactly where we're going. They don't know exactly where they're going, but they're going someplace else. And people who are afraid of the sudden fall back into Stalinism, I think, are worrying themselves for nothing. There may be crackdowns. There may be more repression.
But they'll be temporary. And
but they're not going to go back to the way things were. They can't go back. I mean, that's the reason they're allowing, to a certain degree, these things to happen. That's the reason they didn't send in the tanks the way they did in 56 and the way they did in 68. And you have to ask yourself that. Why not? And I think Gorbachev, among others, have been pretty clear about that. If they're saying it, we can't go back. What we have to do is try to manage change. Now, they want to manage change in ways that you and I might not approve, and certainly in ways in which Russian and Polish and Eastern German workers might not approve, but they're going to try. And so my guess is that whatever the upshot is, it's going to be a much more interesting world for the people in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. It's going to be a world in which they have more room for maneuver, in which they have greater opportunity to craft their own lives, as we said at the output. Now, they're going to have more freedom. It may not be exactly the same kinds of freedoms and lacks of freedoms, the same pattern of restriction and freedom that we have in the West, but it's going to be a more interesting one for them.
Harry, as final question, what is the relevance or lesson of these struggles in the communist world for those of us here in the United States?
I'd say offhand it's the same lesson that we could have drawn from Caracas, Venezuela last spring. If you remember last spring, the people in the slums of Caracas poured into the central city in massive upheaval, a massive struggle against the imposition of austerity by the IMF in Venezuela, and forced a change in policy, not only in Venezuela, but at the level of American policy vis-a-vis the IMF and vis-a-vis the imposition of austerity in the third world and with respect to third world debt. The lesson is that if you want society to change, at all, if you wanted to change radically in the directions that you feel are necessary, you better get organized and you better be prepared to move on an extremely large scale. It's, as I say, the cycle in the East today resembles in some ways the cycle of struggles in the West in the 60s, in the United States, and in Western Europe in the 1960s, from Berkeley to Paris in May of 68. They're very similar, and those are. And what did we see then? Was the most radical change since the 1930s in the West, right?
So maybe it
initially brought in a new period. In the East, it's doing the same thing. How does history change? First and foremost, history changes in the most interesting and the most radical manner when large numbers of people move in concert to change it.
And now, a news story.
There's an article in The Nation for the 15th of May, 1989, which they entitled Democratic Hypocrisy. They say the United States is always saying, unless the Sandinistas sponsor free democratic elections by such and such time, we should resume military aid to the Contras. And they say the same thing about, unless the Soviet Union and the Eastern Europe and Cuba hold free and fair elections, we won't blah, blah, blah. In the meanwhile, what's the United States doing? Well, it funneled millions of dollars into the election in El Salvador many months ago, sent millions of dollars into Panama, down to Panama, and the voting which occurred down there, and now they're openly saying that they're funneling millions of dollars to opposition groups in Nicaragua. Free and fair elections? Well, at least it's out in the open. The Reagan administration did it indirectly through psychological operations, as they called it, such as publishing opposition newsletters, setting up television transmitters to interrupt the regularly scheduled programming with subversive broadcasts, not to mention some of the other more dirty tricks of the CIA going on. The Guardian also has some insights into what is happening in Nicaragua. Through talking with David McMichael, who's the former CIA analyst and specialist on that part of the world. They said the Contras and the Nicaraguan opposition politicians are actually being guided by U.S. officials in Costa Rica and in Nicaragua. He predicted that the administration, the Bush administration, would most likely use the armed return of the Contras as a covert process of disrupting the electoral process. And as a matter of fact, we have seen that the Contras have murdered people who were trying to go down and register to vote. Now, if that didn't work, then they would hope that all this Contra activity would create such a large response, armed response, from the Nicaraguan government, then it'd make the Nicaraguans look bad. Naturally, the Congress, being comprised of fools and dummards, mostly lawyers, so it's understandable. Well, there are a couple of people who have spoken out. Of course, our good friend Henry Gonzalez always is right online when he talks about Central America. But Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat of California, said since the initial announcement of the ceasefire, the Contras have steadily increased their attacks against Nicaragua. But you haven't seen that televised on the regular media. Not only have the attacks on Nicaraguan civilians and soldiers increased, but they've been, as we said, trying to disrupt whatever process is going on out in the countryside to facilitate the elections. And Representative Peter DeFazio, Democrat of Oregon, also said that the mass media have not been recognizing all of these attacks that the Contras have been making since the ceasefire, which, by the way, was just a unilateral ceasefire. They talked about, the media talked about, and the government about the Nicaraguans violating the ceasefire. Well, it was their own ceasefire. The Contras never agreed to it. So in that way, I guess the Contras weren't being so hypocritical, or since they never agreed to a ceasefire in the first place. But the media never give you a real complete picture of what is actually happening down there.
And that brings us to the end of another Alternative Views. Glad you could be with us. We'd like to thank people who helped make the production possible. Brian Lynch was our director. Lisa Henderson and Rob Wittison helped with the editing. And ACTV, we always thank them. And here's our address, Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. If you have any questions or comments about the program, please write us. Goodbye.